From KGW News, this is Straight Talk with Laura Porter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Straight Talk. I'm Laurel Porter. Many of you know how frustrating it can be traveling on I-5 across the interstate bridge. Traffic is often in gridlock. More than 143,000 vehicles cross the bridge every day. Many of those vehicles are semis carrying freight on a vital trade route. Congestion and bridge lifts slow everything down, leading to 7 to 10 hours of congestion during peak travel times. There's also a question of safety. The existing bridge's foundations are made up of timber piles set in sandy soil. A major earthquake would likely substantially damage the bridge, possibly beyond repair. The mayor of Vancouver has said the bridge is the gateway to the future for not only Vancouver and Portland, but the entire region. But if you're like me and you've lived here a long time, it seems like we've been talking about building a new bridge forever. So what gives? How close are we to a new bridge? In this episode of Straight Talk, we get a progress report. When will we know what the bridge will look like? When could construction begin? What's the timeline for a new bridge? And what about jobs? How do you get one? How do local businesses get a contract? We'll answer those questions and more with our guests. Greg Johnson, the program administrator for the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program, or IBR for short. In his role, Johnson represents both the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Washington State Department of Transportation. Johnson is a licensed professional engineer with 20 years experience as a senior executive in the transportation industry. He's worked on major infrastructure projects in both Maryland and Michigan, including early involvement on the Gordie Howe International Bridge project to cross the Detroit River between the United States and Canada. Also joining us, Aiden Gronauer. He is the Assistant Director of Civil Rights and Equity for the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program. He also represents both Oregon and Washington's transportation departments and champions IBR's efforts to bring equity front and center. He's previously worked on equity and sustainability issues for Metro and TriMet. Welcome to my guests, Greg Johnson and Aiden Gronauer. Welcome to Straight Talk. It's nice to have you both here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you for having us.
A couple of times. Aiden, your first time here. Thanks for being here on Straight Talk. And I think one of the first things our viewers wants to know is a progress report. How are we doing? Where are we in the process? When are we going to see construction? We'll begin with Greg.
So, Laura, we are still in what is called the National Environmental Policy Act process, NEPA for short. And we are working towards getting a draft supplemental environmental impact statement out later this year. That's going to be a major, major milestone for the program. And that will lead to getting a record of decision sometime late next year. And that is when we have a federally sanctioned project that we will start seeing dirt being moved, shovels in the ground.
So possibly by the end of 2025.
Yes.
So Aiden, where are we in progress trying to keep equity front and center on this project?
Thank you for that question, Laurel. So the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program is centering equity in everything we do, both through our processes and our outcomes. So this is equity is a continuous work for our program. To name a few of the things that we've been working on so far is we've had our equity advisory group create an equity framework, which helps guide our work, define equity, and hold us accountable to our work. We have also made sure that we have a robust community engagement program and a language access program so that we are reaching and elevating the voices of our equity priority communities. And we're showcasing these efforts on our accountability dashboard that's on our website. We also have an equity lens that's helping guide our decision makers in their thinking through an equity lens, as well as much other work. So again, equity is a continuous process for the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program.
And you mentioned your website. If people want to check it out, interstatebridge.org, if you want to check that out. A lot of people want to know, what is this bridge going to look like? So let's take a look at some new visualizations that came out earlier this year. And we see a single span. We also have the double span and a movable bridge. And that movable bridge means it has a lift, a bridge lift like we have now for a drawbridge. And when the mayor of Vancouver saw these earlier this year, she says, why can't we have a more attractive bridge? And people may wonder, why can't we have a beautiful bridge like the Tillicum Crossing gets so much attention, the Golden Gate Bridge, Greg? Is this what the bridge is going to look like? It doesn't really look that impressive.
So these are just graphics showing different bridge types. This doesn't show what the actual possibilities for special design elements could be. But one of the things that we are very restricted in height, a modern bridge unimpeded by height at its location would be a cable stay bridge, which would have the soaring spires and the tall cables. But we are next to two airports that we cannot punch up into their airspace. So we are restricted on the type of bridge that we can build.
Well, let me ask you about something that everybody saw on television in March. We were horrified when this barge collided with the Francis Scott Key Bridge. This is a bridge in Baltimore that collapsed the bridge. People remember that. Six people, construction workers who were on the bridge, were killed. The Maryland Transportation Department has said that it would take 4 years to rebuild at a cost of $1.7 to $1.9 billion. But recently, that estimate's been upped because of inflation and other things to $3 to $4 billion. Still a fraction of what I understand the cost of the interstate bridge is going to cost here of $5 to $7.5 billion. Why is our bridge, Greg, so much more expensive than rebuilding this Key Bridge?
So, Laurel, I am intimately familiar with the Key Bridge. I was a Maryland State Highway Administrator for 2 years in Maryland, and have driven across that bridge many times when I was out there. This is a different situation. We are actually a 5-mile corridor that we will be putting light rail across the river. We will also be putting bike and pedestrian facilities and rebuilding 7 interchanges. While their bridge, complex and large, it is only a bridge project, just a singular bridge.
And you expect, though, that the cost of the interstate bridge here is going to go up, right, because of inflation. Do you have any idea by how much?
We don't know at this point. We know the inflation spiral that we're seeing on construction projects across the country. And this is a concern to us. As we wrap up our National Environmental Policy Act process, we will be redoing an estimate to give folks an idea of what inflation has done to the cost. And once again, it's a matter of time. Time is the worst enemy of large projects. So we are trying to get this thing started so we can limit the inflationary and escalation that we're seeing across the country.
Talk about time. Back in 2013, when the CRC, the Columbia River Crossing, was scrapped, I think it was like $3 billion maybe we were talking about. So we're talking like more than double that. Are you concerned about the cost? Because where's the money going to come from? Oregon's pledged $1 billion. Washington's pledged $1 billion. The feds have kicked in $600 million. But that's a long ways from $7.5 billion plus.
It is. So one of the things, we have a large grant, and probably one of the largest grant applications this region has seen. We're requesting $1.5 billion from the U.S. Department of Transportation in a big bridge grant. And this was part of the IIJA legislation that was passed. So we are hopeful. We've had visitors as high up as Secretary Buttigieg out here looking at the bridge, as well as the Federal Highway Administrator Shailen Bhatt out here seeing what the issues and the concerns are. So they recognize the criticality of getting this bridge funded and built.
And of course, tolls are going to pay for some of this.
Tolls,
we're going to have tolls.
Tolls will be a part of this process. Bridges of this size across the country generally have tolling as one of their funding streams to help get these things built.
Well, let's talk about how you're going to build it and about the workforce. We'll start with Greg, and then Aiden, you join in. Is this project, you mentioned it's 5 miles of a project with freeway interchanges and expanding the freeway, is this going to be one giant project, or is it going to be many projects? How are you going to do it?
So we had great guidance from both DOTs, both the Oregon Department of Transportation and Washington State Department of Transportation, to say they do not want to see this as one large contract. So we have went about breaking this into, right now we are at 28 different contracts to help get this built. So the bridge will be the first and probably the largest contract, but there will be numerous opportunities for different businesses locally and nationally to have a footprint on this project.
You want to add to that, Aiden?
Absolutely. So this project brings a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for many of our small and disadvantaged businesses and our workforce. So we're trying to be strategic in our approach to make sure that they reap the benefits of these economic opportunities. So as Greg mentioned, 28 different packages. We tried to be strategic in how we debundled those packages so that our small and disadvantaged businesses can see themselves not only as prime contractors on those, but also as subs. We are also historically, since small and disadvantaged businesses have been left out of these opportunities, there has been since the 1980s a program called the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program, where a disadvantaged business enterprise is a small business that is owned and operated by somebody who is considered both socially and economically disadvantaged. So we're ensuring that we maximize our goals on each of these different contract packages to ensure maximum participation, both in the design and the construction opportunities. So we're really looking for creative ways to make sure everybody sees an opportunity for themselves to thrive on this project.
And it may seem overwhelming to some of these small businesses and disadvantaged businesses to become a part of this huge project, dealing with government agencies, staffing up, meeting contract requirements. How are you helping them make it through that process? How are you helping them prepare?
That's a great question, Laurel. So that is true. You know, many small businesses, this can seem overwhelming for them, and we realize that. Really, we believe that access to information is key critical. So we're making sure that all of our small businesses across both states have access to the information. So we're partnering with our community-based organizations across both states to extend our reach into the communities and ensure that the small businesses have access to the information as it comes out, as well as supportive services that these community-based organizations provide small businesses, such as, you know, back office help, helping understand how to read contract language and propose on contracts, as well as access to capital and bonding opportunities. We want to make sure that when our solicitations are ready, our small business community and workforce community are ready.
And Laura, one of the other things that we are doing, our office host office hours, where we invite small businesses or even everyday citizens, neighbors, to come to our office and talk to real people who are involved in the projects to make sure they can get the information they need to interact or be a part of building this project.
And if they want to find out more about that, or they want to actually set up some office hours, they can go to your website?
Yes.
Or the email info@interstatebridge.org. We'll repeat that later on. Aiden, the program also commissioned this workforce study. Why was that needed, and what did you find out through that study?
Oh, so this workforce market study, which is available on our website as well, was key critical to us understanding what's going on in the region as far as other large projects at the same time, as well as what the workforce looks like in our region, so we could understand where the gaps are in the workforce amongst all the different trades and get recommendations on ways that we can grow that workforce as well as diversify that workforce. So this was really important for us to see where the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program and our partners really need to lift up the disadvantaged workforce community to be ready for Interstate Bridge.
And one of the things that you found is there's a big workforce shortage for people of color, for women, and all around. I think 22,000 people you need for this project. Greg, how are you going to make up that shortage? I mean, that's a lot of people. Are you going to be ready for these big, important projects?
I think we will be. We're doing a lot of early pre-work, reaching out to communities. We will have projects that will focus on low-income areas by zip code to make sure that those folks know that these opportunities exist. So we are... We're trying to ring the bell now to get folks' attention and say you can make a great living in the construction industry. These jobs are well-paying to support families. So this is going to be our efforts in the upcoming years to make sure that folks know that we're getting into high school, even junior high, to let folks know about the opportunities that will exist.
You do have a lot of competition, though, don't you, for the workforce?
Yeah, we know that the CHIPS Act is some of the build out of that funding is going to be in competition. We have other infrastructure projects like bridge projects here in Portland. We have projects up in the Puget Sound area that will be competing for the same pot of employees. So We're going to be diligent in getting that outreach done and letting folks know that they can work here close to home and make a great wage.
Well, one of the barriers that the report said that you have for all of these projects, really, mm-hmm. is something that was really discouraging about the persistence of harassment at work sites. So I want to read a quote from the study. And it says, harassment remains a significant issue on job sites. This includes harassment based on gender, race, and other identities, harassment of apprentices, and disrespect often experienced by all workers. Workers also experience isolation and exclusion. This impacts the industry's ability to retain current workers and recruit future workers. The industry has not yet widely adopted policies and practices that effectively address job site harassment and discrimination incidents. Aidan, what is the IBR program doing to address that, to make sure that's not a problem on your job sites? Are there going to be strict uniform policies when it comes to harassment?
Yes, Laura, there will be. So we realize that this is an issue across the nation within the construction industry as well as in our own neighborhood, right? And so the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program is creating those policies and those practices as well as trainings to help interrupt discrimination when it's happening in the moment. Bystander intervention is what it's called. So we are going to be requiring that of all of our contractors on the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program. There will also be mechanisms in place to hold folks accountable. We are also exploring having an ombudsperson on site so that the workforce can go to somebody directly if they feel comfortable, and that there's no barriers to that communication, so that we can make sure that the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program is really a safe and welcoming job site for everyone.
Greg, what about people who are listening who want to get involved with the program? They're thinking about a job, maybe a business that's watching. Are there resources available? How do they get more information?
Yeah, the first step is to get in contact with our office, and we can walk folks through what they need to do to get themselves prepared. We had a large industry meeting in early May where we invited just about 300 different contractors, consultants, small businesses to come in and hear and listen. So we're going to keep those type of efforts up to make sure that people know how to get involved, what things they need to do to be ready, how they can partner up with other contractors or consultants to get a part of this program.
And again, you can check out the website, interstatebridge.org, or go to the email address, info@interstatebridge.org, and ask any questions that you might have, or set up an appointment to have those office hours that you were talking about, Greg. When we come back, we'll look at concerns that some folks who live along the bridge corridor or have businesses there are concerned about the possibility of losing their property through eminent domain. We're back in 2 minutes. Welcome back to Straight Talk. I'm Laurel Porter. We are getting a progress report on the Interstate Bridge Replacement Project. Welcome once again to my guests, IBR's Program Administrator Greg Johnson and Aidan Gronauer, the program's Assistant Director for Civil Rights and Equity. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, Laurel.
As I mentioned before the break, we were going to talk about eminent domain, something called eminent domain. It could affect some residents and some businesses in Oregon and Washington along the bridge corridor, the proposed bridge corridor. There are folks concerned about the possibility that their properties will be taken by eminent domain. Documents obtained by KGW show the project needs to fully or partially acquire a total of 176 parcels, including 43 residential units and 33 businesses, some on Hayden Island, some in downtown Vancouver, including the new Hurley building, others a couple of miles north of Vancouver, where the IBR project would add a bypass off-ramp next to the I-5 interchange with State Route 500. And we talked to one of the residents possibly affected in the Shumway neighborhood. Here is Brenda Palmer. Let's listen.
There's just no answers. They come in and they talk about, well, you know, it's going to be fair, it's going to be equitable, you know, the people that are going to build it are going to be, you know, and I'm like, I don't care about that. I want to know what you're going to do with my house, if anything. And then we'll talk about fair and equitable for the price you give me.
Greg, when you were growing up in Michigan, your family was displaced by an infrastructure project, and you've told me your dad really never got over that. He always talked about it. And you've said you've spent your career making sure folks who are impacted by projects like this have their voices heard and they feel like they are part of the process. So what do you want to say to folks like Brenda, some of these businesses who feel that they really aren't getting answers, that they can't move forward, they're feeling like they're in limbo? What do you want to say to them?
So Laurel, whenever a project has to take property or businesses from people, it is one of the most excruciating things that we have to do as public entities. It is people who have lived in homes and owned businesses, but if there is a footprint, and right now our footprint isn't set, that's why we are not having conversations with folks. The footprint of the project won't be set until we have that final record of decision in 2025. And that's when the process will start in earnest. But the experiences that I bring to this, and I've all over the state of Michigan and even in Maryland have sat and talked to people whose homes were and businesses were impacted by projects. And it is one of the most emotionally charged things that you will do. But We are seeking to be fair and get people notice. Eminent domain is one of the last tools in the toolbox to use when seeking to obtain property for a project. Once we get to that part where the footprint is set, we will be going out, talking to people, having negotiations so they understand all their rights in this process. That's one of the key things, is folks know what's going on and understand what they can agree to, what they can say, no, I'm not accepting that. So there is a very set process that is a federal process that we will be adhering to, because once again, if I were to go out and just kind of willy-nilly start informing some people and not others, it would be unfair. The process would be unfair. So that's why we are adhering closely to the federal process, making sure that folks have their rights protected as we move forward.
So you just don't have enough information right now to be able to talk to folks, it sounds like. So Aiden, what do you want to say about the equity part of that?
Sure. So I agree with Greg. This is an emotionally charged topic for anyone facing these issues. So our equity teams are doing equity analysis to look at any disproportionate impacts on minority and low-income communities. But again, nothing has been set yet. We're still in the initial stages of a draft supplemental environmental impact statement. I would say that access, again, and information is key, critical to the community, so I hear their voices. And as soon as we get that draft out on the streets, we want to hear from the community. We will also be doing robust outreach to make sure that every homeowner is provided information in their language of choice. So we know we have a multilingual community in the Portland-Vancouver area, so making sure that all information is provided and translated into their language of choice, as well as making sure that they know their rights. So we are looking at this through an equity lens, but in the beginning, we're also trying to mitigate any impacts and avoid eminent domain at any cost.
Let me just ask you a really quick question here, and this probably deserves a longer answer, but we're almost out of time. But this Just Crossing Alliance is a group of advocates and activists who say, why can't we just build a bridge, not do all this other stuff, this I-5, you know, expansion of 5 miles and freeway interchanges? Then we wouldn't have to acquire so many properties, wouldn't cost so much. Why can't we just build a bridge, Greg?
Laurel, it's a question we get all the time, and the answer is complex. But this region has agreed on 6 fundamental problem statements. As part of the federal process, you have to have a purpose and need for why you are doing this. So this region has agreed on those purpose and need statements. And just building a bridge does not solve. It solves maybe 1 or 2 of those problems. Putting a bridge back at the same height and level and not coming back, we cannot maintain traffic in the I-5 corridor at the same time. We'd have to shut down I-5 for a number of years. So we're looking at all of these things very carefully, but we know that We cannot solve congestion, freight issues, and all of these things by just replacing the bridge.
I have to stop you there because we're out of time. We need another half hour. But again, you can check out the website there, interstatebridge.org. You can email at info@interstatebridge.org if you have more questions. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening to our podcast. We'll see you next week for Straight Talk.